Good morning, everyone. And seeing how this is the second Sunday that I've been speaking here in our new center, I thought of continuing a little bit with the idea of giving very basic Buddhist teachings. The last time I spoke 2 weeks ago was the Four Noble Truths. And today I'd like to speak about karma. And perhaps karma is not talked about as much in Western Buddhism as that would indicate its central place traditionally in Buddhism. But in Asian Buddhism and the teachings of the Buddha, karma plays a very central role. And to some degree, most of us operate with some appreciation, understanding, or as if karma works, though we don't think about it in those terms. The Dalai Lama has once said, I think he's basically quoting other people, that more important than understanding the great Mahayana philosophy of emptiness is it to understand and appreciate something about the laws of karma, how karma works. And the Zen master Dogen talks about the importance of a deep faith in causality and karma. Most simply, I think of karma, Buddhist teachings of karma, as being a teaching offering or suggesting to us that we can have confidence in our own responsiveness, our own ability to respond and effect a change in our own spiritual life. Is an important thing to have confidence in. And the teaching of karma is pointing to that, that we can take some responsiveness and responsibility. We can make some effect or some change in our life. And the Buddha said that if you couldn't do that, if you could not have some human agency, some free will or some choice that could affect your life, then there'd be no spiritual life. If everything was predetermined, in various ways it could be predetermined, he said there would be no spiritual life. So to have faith or some understanding, appreciation of karma is to have some confidence that we can make a difference, at least in our spiritual life, in our inner life perhaps, certainly also maybe in the life around us. The Buddha, when he taught the teachings of karma, was in part responding to some of the other teachings about karma that existed in India at that time. The word karma simply means action. It means to act, or it means action. So different teachings that people had about action, the efficacy of acting and doing and responding. And there was this Indian tradition that everything was ordained by the gods, and that humans had no real ability to institute any change unless they supplicated the gods. And so there was a whole institution of sacrificing to the gods. If you wanted to have a good harvest or a good life, you would make offerings, sacrificial offerings to the gods, and ask them to intervene, and they would change the course of history for you. But on your own, you couldn't do much. There was also teachings of predeterminism, that everything at the beginning of time was predetermined, and whatever was going to happen to you was predetermined, and you're just along for the ride, and you might as well just, you know, relax and go along with it, whatever comes your way. Other people had a teaching that your past actions had a one-to-one correspondence to what your current experience is in life. So that everything that happens to you today is a result of your past actions, your past choices you've made. And you're responsible for everything that happens to you now. So in a kind of somewhat, that kind of teaching appears sometimes in New Age areas where if someone gets sick, some people will take responsibility for saying, oh, I caused my sickness. There's a one-to-one relationship to my actions and intentions in the past, my attitudes. I'm responsible for the fact that I got sick now. The Buddha was very precise in saying that if that was the case, there'd be no spiritual life. And he said that karma that he was focusing on, the laws of karma in Buddhist traditions, is a subcategory of a larger field of causality. the world is a field of cause and effect relationships, and it's immense. It's huge. So, I mean, who knows why the electricity surges to pop the, you know, to pop the speakers today? I mean, is it because someone decided to turn on their electric power blower in Western Redwood City just at that moment? And, you know, who knows, you know, how things, you know, the causal chain of cause and effect and how that affects something, anything at all. But in terms of our experiences of pleasantness, unpleasantness, suffering, and pain, to some degree, the Buddha said, it's outside of the realm of karma. It belongs to the realm of cause and effect relationships. It belongs to environmental conditions. He had a kind of word that implies, in English, kind of genetic conditions, kind of biological conditions of what you inherited from your parents. And so there's a lot of things which are outside of the realm of your responsiveness, of your responsibility. It just comes with being part of the chain, a field of cause and effect relationships. The point of responsiveness, also the teaching of karma for the Buddha, is a teaching of pointing to the present moment, and pointing to the present moment so we understand in the present moment where our ability to respond resides, where the place of creativity is for our lives. So the teaching of karma is not meant to be some heavy thing about, you know, you are what you are now because of what you did in the past, or some burden, or some predetermined fixed idea, this is the way things have to be. It's really an encouragement for us to look at the place where we can respond. Where is the responsiveness in the present moment? There's an appreciation that all kinds of causes and conditions, and also past karma, past things that we've done and acted on, affect the present moment. And in affecting the present moment, it's just what the present moment is. In a sense, what the present moment is, for the most part, is outside of your control in the present moment. As you arrive in this moment is what it is. The causes and conditions in the past make this moment what it is. And part of Buddhist practice is to learn to have some equanimity, some spaciousness around how things have come into being at this very moment here. But then appreciating that in this very moment, that's where the possibility of responding arises. We can respond to this present moment in some way. And that how we respond is consequential. It's consequential in the moment, but part of the teaching of karma is that it's consequential into the future. And that by taking some responsibility for this moment of potential here, we can affect ourselves and the future destiny of ourselves to some degree. I like to think of it as being, we tend our lives towards certain directions by the choices we make right now. The world of cause and effect is so large that it's hard to know, actually, protect ourselves or arrange ourselves or control our lives to guarantee that it has a certain outcome. But how we intend it now tends our life in certain directions. If you live a life of generosity and kindness, it tends to be the fact then that the world responds in kind. You tend to receive generosity and kindness in return. If you live a life of hate and lying and animosity, to some degree, you tend then to receive that in return. But we can't really control the wider field of cause and effect. So that's why I say we only can tend to create certain consequences. We can't guarantee them. But the law of karma, traditionally in Buddhism, is understood to be a very fixed law, a very clear law of cause and effect. And how I understand that to be is that it's within the domain of our own psyche that there's a kind of more rigid law of cause and effect. That how we intend our responses to be, how we choose to respond in the present moment, tends to condition our psyche in certain way. That our psyche then is habituated, conditioned, in some way to respond or to have certain experiences into the future. So an example that was very helpful for me in understanding karma happened some years ago when I was coming to teach in one of our sitting groups, and I was driving on 280 and I was getting off the off-ramp there on Page Mill. And if you've ever taken that off-ramp, that exit, you know that you come to a stop sign, and it's a four-way stop sign right there. And so I came to my stop sign, and there's a car coming from the left on Page Mill going west, I guess. And I knew that person had a stop sign also. And so it was a lot of time for that person to kind of see the stop sign and stop. And so I thought, well, I'll go ahead because, you know, I had the right of way. I'd stopped, and so I went ahead. The person, I guess, didn't see the stop sign. And we missed each other by an inch, you know, it was very close. And I said, whew, that was close. And then I thought, well, that person was at fault, obviously. That person broke the rules that we set up in our society. And legally, if we've had an accident, I think that person would have taken full responsibility, or at least the insurance company would, or at least the judicial system would have said that person is responsible. But we only missed each other by an inch. And I thought about what are some of the other factors that came into play. And in fact, to a small degree, that particular day it wasn't to a great degree, but a small degree, I was rushing. I was impatient. I was kind of pushing a little bit to kind of get someplace, to come and get someplace I can teach you all to relax. You know, sometimes I come to teach and I'm really teaching myself because, you know, I need this as much as anyone. But anyway, I was kind of in there, kind of doing this thing, right? And if we had that accident, legally, the cause and effect responsibility would have been the other driver. From a karmic point of view of Buddhism, the place of karma, the responsibility would have been my own. Or maybe that's the wrong way of saying it, the responsibility, but the place that's interesting to study, the place that's interesting to take responsibility for, to acknowledge, you wouldn't want to do this publicly to the other person, you know, and mess up the legal thing, but internally, you want to recognize, oh, that wouldn't have happened, probably, if I hadn't had a little extra pushing and impatience and you know, intention to kind of rush to get someplace on time. Karmically, the interesting place of study is the attitude and the intention by which we're acting in the present moment. And so the mindfulness practice is meant in part to help us to pay attention to the place of karmic responsiveness, responsibility, because that's what's going to affect our spiritual life the most. If that accident had happened, the question is, at that moment, the question is, how do I respond to that situation? How would have I responded to this present moment? If I had responded with anger and animosity, I would have tended to a very different cause and effect relationship than if I had responded with patience and generosity or kindness to the situation. If we had had that accident and I had just kind of completely focused on the other person and blamed the other person and turned a blind eye to my own role in being impatient and pushing it, then I would have missed an opportunity to have somehow changed myself or learned from that so in the future I don't add this kind of karmic weight to my own life. Is this making some sense? So how do we respond to what's given to us, what arises in the present moment? And that is really the important issue. And all kinds of horrible and beautiful things can happen to us. Some of it seemingly is luck. Some of it is amazing confluence of cause and effect relationships. Some of it maybe is because of karmic conditioning from the past. But whether it's really beautiful or really amazingly suffering, the issue becomes the same. Is where is the point, where is the place of creativity, of responsiveness, where we then can make a difference for the next moment, for the next moment that's coming, or for the next day, or for the next year. If I'd had that accident, and if I had responded with kindness to the other person, then the next moment, or the next few moments, or the next minute, or the hour, might have been very different than if I had responded with anger. I might have gotten into a fight, or whatever. So how do we respond? So the Buddha, in one passage, defined karma as intention. The intentionality, the volition behind our actions, is what creates this inner realm of cause and effect that's called karma. The inner realm that we can somehow change and condition. We set in motion a certain chain of cause and effect through our actions in the present. But we don't have to be victims of that in the inner life. At some point, we can use our mindfulness to interrupt that or free ourselves from it. So it's not we're not predetermining that everything has to be a certain way. So some years ago, I went to the Women's Federal Prison in Fullerton, is that where it is, in the East Bay? And in the Women's Federal Prison, I was going to teach a one-day retreat on mindfulness to these women. And it was a very memorable experience for a number of reasons. But one of the primary ones was the attitude with which those women came to that retreat. And there was a wide range of attitudes to be seen there. There was this one woman who sat down kind of in front of me, like maybe that far away, really close. And I was just in awe of her because she had devoted her 7 years to date in being in prison to doing yoga and meditation and spiritual practice. And she showed up with this radiance and presence and power that would have been exceptional in normal life. And then there were other women there who were sitting kind of, you know, over to the side, against, kind of leaning against the wall, you know. And I was told they were basically there because there was a guy in town. And they don't have many of them. And also because it was just, you know, kind of apparently a comfortable place to hang out as opposed to the other things they could do. And they weren't really there for the practice or the teachings or anything. And, you know, two groups of people in the same situation, I just imagine a very uncomfortable situation being in prison, federal prison, but their attitude to how they lived that life seemed to be very different from each other. Some people just kind of went along, kind of got by, and kind of this kind of, you know, and to one woman, you know, who actually took that time and infused it a very powerful intentionality and attitude. Both people might leave prison at the same time, but they'd leave very different people by the conditions that they're setting up, by the different attitude and response they're bringing to the same situation. Sometimes two people can enter into the same choices externally, but the inner volition or motivation for those choices makes a world of difference to their future experience. So, for example, the example I've given is if two people started the same business together, business partners, and they both decide to, you know, they both make the same choices about, you know, around business choices, the external choices. But what motivates them in making those choices, one of them is simply to make as much money as quickly as possible. And the other is to create a really healthy working environment for those people who are going to work there. The second one wants to create an environment where the creativity and the welfare and the best qualities of kind of a community can come out. And money is really a secondary issue to creating kind of a social change through that business. After 5 years, the business fails. The person who just wanted money is left with nothing, except maybe disappointment and a sense of failure. The person who was trying to create a healthy business environment might also feel disappointed it didn't work out, but might look back and say, for those 5 years, we had a really great environment. I was really able to help a lot of people and bring out the best in them, and I was kind of like a mentor for a lot of people, and this business really fostered the inner life, the personal lives, the kind of community life of these groups of workers that we hired. And so that second person then leaves that failed business with maybe some sense of satisfaction, some joy about at least something wonderful happened for those 5 years. The inner intention can make a difference in the long-term consequences. So in the practice of mindfulness, then, one of the things we pay attention to is not simply what's happening in the present moment, but also what is the intention that is present for us as we respond to the life around us. What's the intention with which we drive our car? Most of us maybe don't think about that. You know, driving a car is just driving a car. But there's often an intention, a volition, an attitude in driving a car. And that's consequential. There's an attitude in the way we speak. All kinds of intentions come into play with how we speak. There's attitudes related to how we eat, even how we walk or how we sit in a chair. All kinds of actions have volitional intentions behind them. Some of them are not the most obvious ones that we first notice, or someone else might notice, but rather maybe are deeper ones. Maybe some people are fear-based, and underneath their choices they make is a desire for self-protection. Other people might have a very deep sense of empathy for other people, and around various choices they make, underneath that is a sense of empathy, being inspired by a sense of care and connectedness with other people. What is the intention behind our actions? In the teachings of the Buddha, the intention is what sets up it helps create the karmic cause and effect field that then we reap the results of. It's like intentions is considered a seed. And you plant a certain seed and you get a certain plant and fruit as a result. You plant a seed of greed, hate, and delusion, of lying and stealing and deceit and whatever, and you create a very different fruit than if you plant a seed of generosity and love and wisdom or kindness and things like that. So one of the things we study in mindfulness is what is the intention behind our actions? What's the quality of that intention? And it's a quality of that intention which then has consequence, both in the moment, but also in the Buddhist tradition, they say, down into the future. In very traditional Buddhist teachings, they say it actually affects, you know, your future rebirth. And the way that, one way that to understand this is that the choices we make now shapes the spin or the momentum of our consciousness. And a consciousness which is motivated by grasping, and there's many, grasping is a kind of a blanket term for many different ways in which we relate to life, creates a spin of continuing wanting to grasp in consciousness. A habit formation of grasping. And so that we come into a fresh situation and the mind just wants to grasp some more. Grasping kind of, then any kind of new situation the mind wants to grasp. So upon death, in traditional Buddhist teachings, if the mind is still conditioned by wanting to grasp or resist or whatever it might be, then it'll grasp onto the next life. If there's no tendency to grasp, then the person does not get reborn, and the Buddha didn't want to say what happens to the person instead. It can't be said, can't be described, can't be talked about. It didn't want to say that the person didn't exist anymore, but didn't want to say that the person does exist. It just didn't want to talk about it. So we're left kind of hanging until we find out. But kind of moment to moment, I see this kind of the same thing, that if we enter into a new situation, into a new circumstance in our lives, do we enter into it with past conditioning, past momentum, to respond in certain predictable ways? to always go into a new situation and we're ready to grasp, or ready to resist, or ready to judge? Are we predisposing ourselves in certain ways? And so that predisposition is part of the realm of karma. And part of mindfulness is to begin to appreciate our predispositions. And then seeing those predispositions and seeing, can we switch those? Can we choose not to act on them? And a good part of mindfulness practice actually entails learning how to undo, how not to do, because of the tremendous momentum we have of doing, 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 responding a certain way. And part of the power of mindfulness is that, or I say it this way, so the Buddha emphasized that we have ability to respond. Every moment we have ability to respond. One of the powerful forms of response is to be mindful. And to be mindful is, beyond bringing mindfulness to bear on the situation, is a non-responsive approach. It's to allow things to be as they are while we're carefully mindful of what they are. So there's all this momentum in our life. Our past conditioning, our past actions, creates a tremendous momentum. And we have to, in some degree, bear the brunt of that momentum. You can't expect to just sit down in meditation or go on retreat and just kind of snap your fingers and expect that all the momentum just kind of falls away. But part of it, we have to kind of learn to accept that certain amount of momentum is there. And then part of what mindfulness does, or the response of mindfulness, is simply to feel it and be with it. And that feeling and being mindful of that momentum is part of the unraveling of it and freedom from it. It's interesting that Buddha said that our physical experience, our body, is a result of our past karma. And our responsibility is to feel it and be with it. And in the doing that, discover our freedom. So our past catches up to us in the present to some degree. Our karmic pasts, our dispositions, intentions, catches up to us in the present moment if we stop to pay attention to that. If we barrel ahead, driving down to the, you know, page mill then, as if nothing, you know, kind of still preoccupied about where you're going or whatever, then we actually continue to wind up the spring of karma. But because of this near accident, I kind of stopped in a sense, and as I was driving down Page Mill, I reflected and became aware of the attitude with which I was driving. It caught up to me because I was mindful. And then I was able to choose something else. And some of the energy and excitement of, you know, rushing persisted in my body. But I just had to kind of take its course. I just allowed it to be there. It's very impressive to go on retreat. Those of you who have been there know this. The first days of the retreat especially is often an experience of our past catching up to us. Sometimes it feels like we hit a wall because all this intentionality and dispositions and attitudes that kind of we're constantly winding up more and more and more, we stop winding it up, and then we discover how wound up we are. And some people at that point decide, well, forget this. I think I'll go back to life as it was, which means you go back and wind up some more. And the reason you don't see the suffering of the winding upness is because we're preoccupied with the process of winding, preoccupied with that forward direction of wanting and grasping and doing often. And part of the process of mindfulness practice is to stop and let our life catch up to us. Let the momentum of that intentionality, as it's carried in our muscles, in our mind, in our brain, to catch up to us so we see it, so that it has a chance to unwind. When we stop winding up the spring and feel it with mindfulness, with awareness, the spring will begin to unwind. Sometimes I've had the sense that when I sit to meditate, it's like pulling the plug in the bathtub. And in its own way, the water just drains away. Unless, of course, I react to what comes up, you know, to the water. So the role of mindfulness practice is to help place us in the juncture of the present, to help us see where our ability to respond resides. Without seeing where our ability to respond resides, there is no ability to respond. And then we are, in a sense, carried along by fate or carried along by all kinds of conditions that can feel like fate or destiny or predeterminism or the gods, whatever. But part of mindfulness is to help put us in a place of responsiveness and then to learn to begin to take responsibility for that place. And by taking responsibility for our ability to respond in the present moment, we change the course of our life. We change the course of our spiritual life. And it's possible then to move our life in the direction of increased, certainly freedom, but also to move in the direction of greater happiness, goodness, love, peace. So that's enough for me. Now I'm going to give you a chance to respond. Yes? In the Buddhist world, we tend not to use the word reincarnation. I think the reason for that is that reincarnation implies that there's something that enters into a new body, reincarnates. Rebirth, apparently, Buddhists say, doesn't have the same implication, so we use the word rebirth. I don't really know so much about... I don't know about this, you know, from firsthand, how this works. And if I'm going to talk about, you know, how rebirth works and all that, it's really textbook responses, you know, things I've learned. And I've tried to study this things, how this stuff works well. And you know, I've never felt that it really... I never felt like I got a really good answer, you know, how it works. You can kind of believe... some people intuit or feel that, you know, this is intuitively right, this teaching, and some people say they have experiences of their past lives, and so they know from their own experience how this works. But the best kind of analogy that I have for understanding rebirth in the traditional Buddhist sense is the analogy of a wave traveling across the Pacific from Japan to California. You can see, you know, from a distance, you see the wave, you say, that's the wave. You can follow the wave, trace it, and you know, it's the same wave going all the way across. But if you look really carefully, there's no water molecules moving across the Pacific. It's the same, water molecules are just simply moving up and down. And they knock the one next to it, and that goes up and down. And so there's no thing being moved across the Pacific. In a sense, it's just energy, you might say. Or it's like a wave in a football stadium. You know, there's no people moving down the seats. There's no hands moving down seats, but it looks like movement, because they were coordinating how they wave their hands. So when rebirth happens, there's no thing which gets reborn. But there is momentum that's set in motion. And somehow the consciousness, the intentionality of your responses in the present conditions that your consciousness. And as you die, that consciousness has a certain spin on it, spin of grasping, for example. And that then will bump into another consciousness and add that spin to the next consciousness. And so there is an effect from one lifetime to the next. Exactly what that effect will be, there's no kind of predetermined way of knowing absolutely that this is the way things are going to be. It tends to certain results. Does this respond to your question? To some extent. Why did you ask the question?
Oh, well, I have this one spiritual teacher who does not totally ascribe to Buddhism, but, you know, to spirituality in its generic form. And he told me at one point that our previous lives and previous decisions affect future lives. And that one reason I was having so much pain was that I must have tortured someone in my past life. And I've thought about that ever since. I mean, this is like 5 or 6 years ago. And
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, you know, is there any truth to this? I mean, there's always the Western tendency to use karma in the context of blame.
Yeah, right.
I didn't talk about that.
Yeah. So my reading of the Buddha is he didn't want it to be that way. And he said explicitly it's very hard to understand, it's impossible to understand how karma really works. And if you try to understand it, your head will explode in 7 pieces. What? Certainly in the teachings of the Buddha, he recognized that there can be that kind of effect from one lifetime to the next. But to understand for sure that that's the case, and to assume that there's a necessary correlate, that every time someone has a physical ailment, it has to be because of some kind of thing they did in the past, that he didn't want to go that far. That sometimes that's the case, but, you know, not always. So I had for a while kind of this problem with my wrists because, you know, when I was doing my dissertation, I was on the computer a lot. And so why did I have that thing in my wrist? Well, the simple reason is because I rested my wrists, you know, against the keyboard there and pressed against it. But so maybe that's part of what working on the computer entails, is doing that. But I think you don't have to do that. If I paid attention very carefully and very honestly to the intentionality or the attitude, the predisposition behind it, probably there were times where I felt really burdened, oppressed, which is an attitude that I took on. And so I was kind of like leaning in, oh, one more word, you know, one more footnote. And part of the reason, part of the karmic reason why I had the problem in my wrist was because I was allowing myself to be carried along by this sense of burden. So I was leaning in, right? So there you can see there's a cause and effect relationship. But I've had other kind of situations where I can't for the life of me figure out where my intentionality is part of it. It might be past lifetimes. But I think from the teachings of the Buddha, I think the way he's teaching is that it's not so interesting to know that. You know, it's not so interesting. It's not even that relevant to know whether you're responsible, not responsible from the past. The present moment is what it is. And it's how you respond in the present moment which is important. It doesn't, that's my take on it. So whether you tortured someone or not.
I probably can't somewhere. Even in this life.
So I think of the teaching of karma as being a kind of an optimistic one that is meant not to make us victims of our past and not to make us oppressed by a sense of blame. You know, that you know I did it to myself and therefore I'm terrible. The Buddha said something like, judging others is not for your own benefit. And probably we should, here in America, we should say, judging yourself is not to your own benefit. And sometimes the difference that we can make by how we respond in the present can seem inconsequential in and of itself, but as with enough drops, the bathtub is filled. With enough small little moments of intentionality, we make a difference in the long term. And it might take 10 years to make a difference, or 20 years, or in traditional language, maybe it takes a few lifetimes. But we can make a difference. More responses? Objections? Testimonials? Yes?
A question. Trying to stop this winding up, how does that relate to this notion of sitting still, of just being still? Is that connected to being able to get a better relationship to the present?
It can be. Of course, sitting still can be done out of great fear and and kind of hiding and kind of bracing ourselves against life. So sitting still in and of itself, but the metaphoric or the metaphoric use of the word sitting still is that sitting in such a way that we allow things to be as they are without acting on anything except knowing carefully for what it is allows this karmic stream to unwind and to clarify itself. So, I mean, sitting still is very powerful, but you can sit still by doing, by sitting still doesn't have to necessarily mean sitting still. I don't know if I'm answering, but do you want to say, ask some more?
I'm always interested in the relationship of what we do when we come in here and then the talk, and always trying to put those pieces together, and just trying to understand what I'm doing. That time beforehand, and then trying to relate that to what you're saying. So I'm sitting, sitting, and now I'm listening. Just trying to understand the connection.
I love it. So when I sat here during the sitting part of this morning, one of the things that I became aware of was the momentum of my own clinging. I could feel it around my eyes, and I think just simply driving down here and kind of being involved in life. There was kind of this attitude, or this kind of forward, doing things and getting things done. That had kind of a little bit grasping quality, that affected my muscles and my body. And what's interesting, when I first sat down to meditate, I was happy to be here. I was getting quiet and calm, and it wasn't that level of tension in my body wasn't obvious. But then after I sat for 5 or 10 minutes, and kind of the surface kind of settling and happened. Then this deeper kind of tension became manifest. And part of the sitting process was just noticing that and noticing how that as I sat, it began to continue to unwind and relax in my eyes and my cheeks and my shoulders, kind of that layer kind of unwound itself. I also, as I was sitting here, noticed at some point that I was supposed to give a talk in a few minutes. And so then a little of concern or maybe a little worry about, okay, I better have something to say arose. And so I noticed that and I said, I don't want to live my life that way. I'm going to choose not to follow through on that kind of concern about when I'm sitting because that's not for my betterment and it's probably not for your betterment if I kind of am worrying ahead of time. So I could see that I have a moment of choice here, and the choice was I'm not going to follow that one. And in fact, often sitting is we often find in sitting a place where I'm going to choose not to follow that train of thought or that kind of attitude or that response, or perhaps simply seeing it clearly, seeing it very very clearly. Oh, that's what's going on. That's enough to kind of step outside of that involvement of it. And then with time, it kind of dissipates by itself. So there's this emphasis on responsiveness, I think, comes into play moment by moment in sitting practice. And it makes a difference. So I studied it also. Yes?
One thing has occurred to me about karma and rebirth, and that is that I can clearly experience the connection between my intentions and my own ongoing. That actually tracks if I pay attention to it.
Right, right. And that for me, that's enough. I don't need to. I never felt a need to adopt or to the Buddhist teachings of rebirth. I'm basically an agnostic about it. And some Buddhist teachers would be horrified. That there's this Buddhist teacher out there who is an agnostic about it. I mean, really, because some Buddhist teachers feel it's, Buddhism doesn't make sense without the belief in rebirth. And maybe that's the case, but I am who I am. Yeah.
We've had a discussion with Dr. Taylor that the foundation of life is a teacher of the community and lead brave intent. And we all
to the Pascal's Wager about God. Is that what it's called? Pascal's Wager. There was a similar teachings in the suttas where the Buddha said that you have nothing to lose in believing in rebirth, because if you believe in it, that, and believe in karma and believe that what you do here can beneficially affect your future rebirth, then it's your good actions that beneficially affect your rebirth. So if you believe in it, then you'll do good things. You'll live a good life. And that's good. And if rebirth doesn't exist, the Buddha said, then you get all these benefits in this lifetime anyway. So you might as well, you know, live as if it's true, because you're not, you know, karmically you're not going to go wrong then. Pascal's Wager in Buddhist language. So last one, and then we'll stop. Yes. It's like what I said last Sunday. I said there was this guy who once told me that if I hadn't been so sincere, he would have punched me out.
Same idea.
So, thank you.